Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Taxes Committee for March 14th, 2023. We have a quorum present. Our first item on the agenda is to approve the minutes from March 9th. Vice Chair Norris, have you had a chance to check out the minutes?
I have, and I will move the minutes from the March 9th meeting.
Excellent. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, please say no. Motion prevails, and we have adopted the minutes from March 9th, 2023. So, members, we are finishing up our conversation on House Files 300 and 1040, which we started on Thursday. We heard a lot of testimony from community, and so we're going to have two testifiers who I kicked off the schedule on Thursday because they're here every day, and so we're going to hear from those guys, and then we're going to have member discussion. And we're hoping to our two authors have, as you guys know, it's like busy time, so they have to run to another committee. So we're hoping, you know, I want everybody to have a chance to express themselves on this issue that I know is of import to all of us. And but I would ask us kind of just, you know, to keep our comments brief. We're going to have more chance to discuss this important issue as we move forward with session. Representative Davids.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the last meeting you gave it very fair, and you gave it, you know, a lot of attention. I'm hoping we don't need to have a whole lot of discussion. That's not up to me, obviously. But we've heard the bill for a whole committee hearing and a couple testifiers, and then looks like we have a full agenda anyways.
Yes, we do. So we have other bills that we're going to hear in kind of the second half of the committee. So thank you for that, Representative Davids. With that, we're going to go back to public testimony on House File 1040 and House File 300. I have two folks left on the list who would like to testify. Mr. Rice, welcome back to the committee. I think we've heard from you this session. I can't remember, but in any case, welcome back to taxes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my first appearance
before
the tax committee this year.
Excellent.
And, thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I'm here today on behalf of the St. Paul Teachers Pension Fund and their retirees. St. Paul Teachers is a fund of over 10,000 active retired teachers. I'm addressing Section 2 of House File 300, and it's a very distinct provision from what you talked about on Social Security. In 2017 and 2019, this committee decided to carve out a pension subtraction for Social Security recipients. Unfortunately, you left behind about 25,000 public employees who are retired. Teachers hired before 77, all police and firefighters, federal workers, postal workers, VA workers, city workers, Minneapolis. They're called basic plan members. And basically the situation there, you have this pink handout, explains the background. These were pension funds that were established before there was Social Security, and these plans continued for many, many years. And they don't get Social Security from their primary earnings. You've got two other documents that are really, really critical. If you say, well, they get Social Security anyway, wrong, absolutely wrong. There's a thing called the windfall elimination provision that applies to people that have basic plans but otherwise get Social Security, and basically it cuts their benefits from Social Security at least in half. And there's another thing called the government pension offset. So let's say you were married to somebody and you had one of these basic plans and they had Social Security. Guess what? You're not going to get their Social Security pension, because these state workers and federal workers, honestly, Madam Chair, are treated as second-class citizens. What you did for everyone else in the state, you did not do for this cohort. And that's why we're begging you to extend this pension subtraction to these. These are your firefighters. These are your police officers. If somebody goes down in here and you see a St. Paul firefighter coming through the door, they don't get the same tax treatment you give everybody else in the state. Or they're the postal workers who they've now been retired, but they don't get Social Security for their work, or their VA. Or they're these teachers, as you heard from Louise Sundin last week, that taught your kids or probably even taught you folks at some point in their career. They don't get it. And I might add, you, Madam Chair, have signed on this bill when Diane Loeffler had it. Representative, former chair Davids, always emeritus chair of the Tax Committee, you signed on to the bill. Representative Howard, you did. And most importantly, our own Mike Howard from St. Paul has a version of this bill, House File 2367, that just deals with Section 2 of the Lisligard bill that calls out these people. And so really, I'm making as strong a plea as I can on behalf of these fellow Minnesotans. By the way, over 90% of all public employees stay in the state. They don't move out. It's about 94% when we worked on the 2018 pension bill. This is not a cohort of people that are flying south. They live here. Matter of fact, you have some people that you know. Linda Slocum, Lynn Carlson, Mary Murphy, these are all, now they may not get covered by just a subtraction thing, but those are workers that really depend on you. And, the last point, I'll wrap it up. These basic plan workers that the state provides for have gotten a 1% COLA. 1%.
Yep.
They're really hurting, Madam Chair. So anything you can do on that, and Representative Lisligard, many, many thanks to you for carrying this bill and getting us in, at least in the discussion. This is as far as we've been able to come in the last 6 years, and I honestly appreciate your time and attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rice. As long as we're referring to Representative Davids as Chair Emeritus and not Memorial Chair, then I think we're in good shape.
Madam Chair, how do you spell Emeritus? On my business card.
Thank you. I just want to say briefly before we go on to our last testifier, as you know, Mr. Rice, I called you when I saw Representative Lisligard's bill, and I was like, wait, so you want the basic plan members and, you know, the sort of folks who were left behind in this action that we took on the Social Security subtraction to just be treated as we do Social Security income now, whereas for me personally, I will just tell you that as we move forward in this process, my intention is that we treat those who are, you know, the income that's being received under the basic plan the same way that we treat Social Security income as we move forward with this process, whatever our approach is. So I just wanted to say that because, you know, the proposal right now, as I said, is like to treat those pensioners how we treat Social Security right now, income right now, but we know we're likely to change that treatment. And so I believe that we need to just, you know, this principle of horizontal equity in taxes is something, and fairness, that is something that we've talked about in this committee. So that's our intention moving forward.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and Madam Chair, and thank you for cleaning up my testimony because that is our request.
Oh, okay.
Whatever you do for everyone else, please. I mean, this is a cohort of people that have just been forgotten. I mean,
yeah.
They're like the lost tribe of Israel. Everybody doesn't think they exist.
Well, we're going to remember them in 2023. Thank you. As we move forward with this negotiation. Thanks. Up next, Eric Bernstein.
Chair Gomez, members of the committee, my name is Eric Bernstein, and I am the director of We Make Minnesota. We're a labor grassroots coalition united around the foundational importance of our state budget. Thank you for the opportunity to express our concerns about the elimination of state taxes on Social Security benefits. Our members, the members of our coalition, they care for young children, the sick, and the elderly. They educate future generations, and they keep our state and our cities running. Their work is essential for sustaining a functioning society and a strong economy, but it is not profitable in a narrow sense. It requires our collective commitment. Last week, we heard their concerns about the impact that this ongoing tax cut will have on their workplaces and communities. We also heard their opposition to tax cuts that would go overwhelmingly to higher-income retirees. I share these concerns. This policy is poorly targeted to help those in need, and it poses a serious ongoing budgetary challenge. According to data from the Social Security Administration and the DOR, the majority of Minnesota seniors, including 75,000 living in poverty, would not benefit from this tax cut. Among those who would benefit, the tax savings are tilted heavily towards the top. Retirees making under $50,000 would save just $4 per week, while those making six-figure incomes, a substantial sum in retirement, would save thousands each year and capture nearly 70% of the tax cut's total cost. My even greater concern is for the state's ability to meet its ongoing public investment needs. Roughly two-thirds of the surplus is one-time money, which cannot compensate for a permanent cut. Minnesota is already spending a smaller share of total economic output on public goods and services than it did in decades past, and this policy would permanently reduce our capacity to recover. If this money leaves the tax base, it will never return. These revenues will require replacement later, and when that happens, we will be forced to raise it from a smaller pool. The burden will shift onto younger families, lower-income workers, and property taxes. The rest will come out of services lost, like affordable child care, college, and more. Shrinking the base and raising the rates, as we've heard in this committee recently, is canonically bad tax policy, and that's precisely what this proposal represents. And with the money going mostly to wealthy retirees, we would get little in return. We urge you to protect our budget and tax base for the welfare of all Minnesotans and the public goods and services that they rely on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. So just because we're doing this like a little bit weird because we're hearing two bills at once, we're basically going to do member discussion on the bills, and then we're going to lay them over afterwards and do the sort of official action of the committee. So now we're going to turn to member discussion. If there's anybody who wishes to speak on House File 300 and or House File 1040. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the great discussion we've had on both these bills in committee. As I mentioned on the floor, I think the Liz Lagarde bill is fantastic. It's an improvement on my bill, and I hope that the committee will adopt that approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson B.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm wondering, so this is more of a hypothetical conversation or question that I have for the committee. You know, my grandfather, he's 94 years old. He fought in Korea. He protected our freedoms. He farmed his entire life. He had to buy his farm back after losing it during the farm crisis. He worked very hard every single day of his life. He's now 94 years old. My grandmother just passed away in January. And he's one of those individuals that we identify as the greatest generation. And my question, hypothetically, is, when are we finally going to get off the backs of the greatest generation? When are we finally going to release them from their obligations, their servitude, and we can finally say, hey, thank you for what you have done. Now we can take the mantle. It's very important to understand that when we're talking about this, these individuals are not just, you know, 65-year-old retirees. These are very elderly individuals who are having a very hard time making ends meet. Yeah, my grandfather's got farmland, but at the end of the day, the cost of his care exceeds that of the rent that he receives on his farm. It exceeds that of the Social Security that he receives. And guess what? He still pays taxes on the income that he receives as a landowner of the land that I'm farming. So I'm just curious, when are we finally going to say thank you for all that you have done? It is now time for the younger generations to become the great generation and let the greatest generation go. Because this is really concerning to me. And as a result, I mean, we're still, whatever we do, if we don't adopt House File 300, if we don't completely exempt Social Security taxes, understand that we're going to continue to be that island. And we're going to tell people, retire somewhere else. And we had a lot of retirees who said, I want to be taxed. That's fine. I understand that. We have a $17.5 billion surplus. That's great. That means we have way more than what we need. But also, these individuals, regardless of whether or not their Social Security is exempted, they are paying taxes. They're paying it on their other earned incomes. They're also paying it in the form of sales tax. They're paying the gas tax. They're paying these taxes, and we want them to be here. When we become that island and we say, we don't want you to retire here, that means we don't want you to spend your money here, and we don't want to obtain that extra income somewhere else. So my hypothetical to this committee is, when will we finally step up and let the greatest generation be done? We say, hey, thank you for your service. You've done great work. Now retire in peace.
Representative Davids.
Thank you. And the bills I wasn't going to comment on, I'm going to comment on. I did find interesting many folks that were against the Liz Lagarde bill say, well, we want to be taxed. I just want to inform the world that if you want to pay more in taxes, you can send it to the Department of Revenue anytime you want. So if you want to pay more, send extra in, that's fine. But let's get the Liz Lagarde bill passed.
Thank you. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. And I want to begin by thanking Chair Liz Lagarde for his work on this bill. It's been great to partner with him in championing the bill here in the Minnesota House. And you know, part of what animates my support for House File 300 is experience I had a couple years ago working with AARP. It was during the pandemic, and we discovered that because of some nuances in Minnesota law, most seniors who were receiving Social Security benefits were not eligible to receive unemployment insurance. And you know, at first that was kind of a disconnect for folks, of saying, well, you know, if they're on Social Security, why do they need unemployment insurance? And the reality is, you know, for a lot of seniors, it's not just about, you know, living the good life by the pool with the mortgage paid off anymore. Many are having to work, which ironically makes them more likely to have to pay tax on their Social Security benefits. And, you know, many still have a mortgage. Property taxes are skyrocketing. We've got medical payments and student debt. I actually learned that seniors are the fastest growing holders of student debt in our country, either because they co-signed for somebody or because they went back to school and haven't been able to pay that off. And so, you know, I look at the slides that Mr. Williams prepared for us, and I look at, you know, 66% of people in the 25,000 to 50,000 bracket are paying tax on their Social Security benefits. You know, 93% of them in the 50 to 75,000 range, 97% in kind of the 75 to $100,000 range. You know, those are our middle income seniors who have been working hard their whole lives. I'm really excited about the public pension part in the bill as well. I mean, the people in that income bracket, those are our, you know, teacher and nurse households or our electrician and firefighter households. But I also feel like, you know, we need to make sure that our seniors feel like they've got a place at the table up here at the Capitol. We've talked about a lot of really good stuff this year in the tax committee, the child tax credit, the dependent care credit, a working family credit, massive investments in education more broadly. The governor has talked about, you know, making this the best state in the country to raise a family, and I love that. I come from a youth development background. But we also have to keep in mind our seniors who have, you know, over the decades helped to lay the groundwork for the state's thriving economy that's given us this record surplus. And lastly, I'll just say, you know, another thing that really motivates me to support this bill is the fact that it's what the people of Minnesota are asking for. You know, it's the number one issue I hear about from seniors in my district. I've got, you know, these are all the emails I've been receiving from my constituents on this particular issue. I was even out 2 days after the election picking up some signs, and it was one of those, you know, really, you know, gray, raw November days. It was kind of raining, so there weren't many people out. But I did end up talking to one person who had he had my sign in his yard, and the one issue he brought up to me, he said, make sure you address the tax on Social Security benefits. So, you know, to all the seniors in my district and across the state, I want you to know I'm working as hard as I can for you, and I'm looking forward to working with my colleagues and delivering on this issue for you where past attempts have failed.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'd like to kind of recount my personal experience, since I am, as I like to say, otherwise retired. In fact, my own Social Security check right now is bigger than my legislative paycheck. But between the two, plus you know, I get about you know, $500 a month in a defined benefit pension from Northwest Airlines from my airline days. We have to withdraw about $15,000 a year from our retirement accounts as required minimum withdrawals. I use TurboTax to do my taxes. And for the last several years, I've done an exercise where I put all my Social Security income first just to see what my tax liability would be if my only income was my Social Security. And every year it comes back and says, you have no federal or state tax liability. In fact, we know that in Minnesota, over half of our Social Security recipients pay no tax on their income, and that a majority of Social Security income is not subject to state income taxation. So this year I did it the opposite way. I put in all of my other income first, and then added my Social Security income in as the last step. And without any, if my Social Security income was non-existent or, you know, totally excluded, the answer came back that I would owe about $2,000 in state income tax on a $115,000 adjusted gross income. So then when I added in my Social Security income, that went up to about $5,000. So it's about a $3,000 difference, but I'm still paying 5% on $115,000 AGI. And we talked about medical care. I think one of us brought up medical care costs. So I'm on Medicare as well, my wife and I. This year we're on a Medicare Advantage plan that has a zero premium. So we pay our monthly Part B premium about $155 a month. It's deducted directly from my Social Security tax. But otherwise, my health insurance is also free. So if I, you know, look at my priorities, and I should add on, I mean, I do believe that we do should be providing some relief, just if no other reason for inflation. I was a co-author on Jess Hansen's bill last session. I'm a co-author on her bill this year as well that would raise the amount of income that's the income limit for, you know, below which Social Security income is totally exempt to like $80,000 or $85,000. And that's what I campaigned on, that I do believe that seniors should receive some relief if for inflation, if for nothing else. But I think I look at the other priorities that we have with this money. I think that the generation that is mostly in need right now is people who are trying to raise a family. And that's where I think we ought to be putting most of our tax relief. Thank you.
Great. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to speak in favor of Representative Liz Legarde's bill. I support the full elimination of Social Security and fully understand the pension issues here. And I think it's only fair that at least the Social Security percent, I don't know how you want to say that, because some of this is a public pension and some of it is, you know, replacement of Social Security, but clearly they should be treated the same way as everyone else in the state of Minnesota. I want to talk, I'll give you a very brief thing about my parents, who are both retirees. They have, my mom is a retired state employee, she worked at the DNR forever. My dad is a retired airline mechanic from what was Northwest, so now it's Delta. And their pensions, so they have full defined benefit pensions. But the Delta pension is, there is no COLA on that. And that's a big change 20 years into retirement. The value of that has dramatically dropped for my father. My mother, the COLAs are, I think, 1% recently, and I don't think they're expected to go up. So the pensions are not keeping pace at all with their expenses. They still pay, they're in the same home, they pay property taxes, they pay sales taxes, they pay every other tax. But they're of that sort of income level, just with public pensions, essentially, or pensions, where they're over this income level. And that is the way I think many, many of our two-income, you know, married seniors are. And they're not wealthy. I mean, I grew up in a middle-class household, and these are not wealthy folks, and they need the break. And if we are one of just very few states that still tax full benefits on Social Security and are taxing our seniors, and I think if we can't do it this year when we have such a huge surplus, you know, there will be no hope ever for our seniors that they're going to have Social Security taxes eliminated. So I urge you to support House File 300 and hope that's part of the overall bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further member discussion? All right, we're going to move to laying the bills over then. Chair Lissagard, would you like to move that House File 300 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill?
So moved.
Excellent. I understand there's an A1 author's amendment. We're just going to do this with him at the table, if that's okay with everyone, because he's got another engagement.
So moved on the amendment.
Thank you. All those in favor of the A1 author's amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, please say no. All right, motion carries. Bill's in the form that the author would like. Any closing comments on your bill, Representative Lissagard?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the committee members for the wonderful dialogue and the heartfelt, right, different positions and different understanding. And so I just think that this this conversation needs to continue in depth, and that's where I'm committed to doing. And I apologize, but I have to go present two bills in the other committee, so I'm not being disrespectful because you only laid it over. I have another bill.
And I'll just, on behalf of Representative Lissegaard, thank you all for all of the praise that you've heaped on him over the last week. He appreciates it mightily. All right. Good luck with your bills, Chair Lissegaard. So with that, he's going to renew his motion, even though he left, that House File 300 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, and it is laid over. Next, in the absence of, is she here? Okay. Oh, well, can I just move the bill? Oh, sorry. I'm going to speak slowly while Representative Hansen makes her way to the committee room. I'm going to move that House File 1040 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Welcome, Representative Hansen. Perfect timing. I just to get you caught up, I just moved your that your bill be laid over. I'm also going to, I understand there's a DE1 amendment. I'm also going to move the DE1 amendment so the bill is in the shape the author would like. Do you want to just really briefly just describe your amendment?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. I just ran from another committee. You can see me there on YouTube, I guess. And so I rushed through that to get here, and I just appreciate all of your support. So the DE amendment just gets the bill in the shape that I want. It makes sure that we have a hold harmless clause as well. So in the event that this bill, albeit our best efforts, inadvertently results in somebody who does not currently pay Social Security taxes now, if they have to under this new language, this language will hold them harmless of that. And I'm pretty sure I got that right with that amendment.
So, great. Thank you, Chair. Is there any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, please say no. DE1 is adopted, and the bill is in the shape the author would like. So at this time, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1040, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And it is laid over. Thank you. Excellent. 30 seconds in front of our committee. Appreciate it. Thanks, everybody, for helping us move through our agenda. I greatly appreciate it. All right. Next up. Oh, do we have a Gomez bill? Oh, okay. Ooh, okay. There we go. See? He knows. Okay. I forgot this was happening. It's okay.
All right. Welcome to your committee, Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
All right. Chair Gomez moves that House File 2581 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And Chair Gomez, would you like our fantastic nonpartisan staff to give us an overview of the bill? Or?
Oh, please.
All right. Mr. Williams.
Chair Norris and members, House File 2581 is another federal conformity or update bill similar to what we heard earlier in session in our first hearing. The bill that was enacted in Chapter 1 updated the state's definition of the Internal Revenue Code to reference the code as amended through December 15th, 2023. House File 2581 would change that to it's under current law amended through December 15th, 2022. There's actually a mistake in the bill summary on that. But The House File 2581 would update the Internal Revenue Code definition to reference the code as amended through March 1st of this year. There's been one act of Congress that has been passed since December 15th, and that's called the Federal Secure 2.0 Act. This is a policy that largely deals with retirement tax policy. There's an earlier version that was Secure 1.0, I guess, that was passed a couple of years ago. So this is sort of a follow-up act to that. Many of the provisions in that act do not affect state liability. They don't affect any federal or state income definitions. So they're not sort of covered in detail in the summary. But if you look at the summary and the revenue estimate, I'm going to talk briefly about the provisions that the Department of Revenue has identified as having a state revenue effect. So if you're looking at the bill summary, Section 114, this relates to an existing provision in current law that allows individuals who sell stock to an employee stock ownership program, or an ESOP. Under current law, C corporations are allowed to sell stock to an ESOP, and when they do that, there's a provision that allows them to defer a gain on the stock that's sold to the ESOP. Secure 2.0 allows S corporations to take place under that under certain circumstances as well. Section 115 of the bill allows individuals to take withdrawals from retirement accounts for certain emergency expenses. So this is individuals who have what the bill calls unforeseeable or immediate financial needs relating to personal or family emergency expenses. They're allowed to take one distribution from retirement accounts per year of $1,000, and then also allowed to repay that distribution within 3 years. The distribution would be initially taxed, but if it is repaid, it would be treated as a rollover contribution and not taxed. And so that's the reason it affects state revenues. Section 116 of the Federal Act allows non-elective contributions to simple retirement accounts. So under current law, employer contributions to simple retirement accounts are limited to 2% of compensation or 3% of employee elective deferral contributions. And Secure 2.0 allows employers to make additional contributions up to the lesser of 10% of compensation or $5,000. Section 126 of the Secure Act adopts special rules relating to distributions from long-term qualified tuition programs, which are commonly called 529 college savings plans. That allows beneficiaries from a Section 529 plan to make penalty and tax-free rollovers to Roth IRAs. Section 307. Section 307 of the Secure 2.0 Act. This relates to qualified charitable distributions. So this is instances where you take a distribution from a retirement account that's paid directly to a tax-deductible charitable organization. Under current law, you're allowed to make up to $100,000 per year of distributions. The Secure Act federally indexes that $100,000 limit for inflation. It also allows a one-time $50,000 charitable distribution to what the bill defines as a split interest entity. I discussed what these split interest entities are in the bill summary a little bit. To the extent that committee members have interest, I could look into these in more detail, but this is pretty esoteric stuff, and that's sort of probably the level at which I can discuss it at this moment. Section 309 is an exclusion for disability-related first responder retirement payments. So this is effective for tax year 2027. Service-connected disability pension payments are excluded from gross income federally, so we'd be adopting that for state purposes as well. It would apply to law enforcement officers, firefighters, paramedics, or emergency medical technicians. Section 331 relates to individuals who are in federally declared disaster areas. So you may remember from earlier conformity bills, there is a provision similar to this that was sort of time-limited. And this establishes federally a permanent rule that an individual in a federally declared disaster area can take a penalty-free distribution from their retirement account. It's up to $22,000. In order to qualify for this, they would have to sustain an economic loss as a result of the disaster. The way this would be treated for tax purposes is it would be included ratably in taxable income over 3 years. So the distribution would be spread over 3 years for tax purposes. Section 605 relates to charitable contribution easements. This disallows the charitable contribution deduction for a partnership that makes a qualified charitable contribution conservation contribution if the value of the deduction exceeds 2.5 times the sum of each partner's basis in the partnership. And this is a limitation. The IRS in 2017 identified these charitable contribution easements as having a high potential for tax avoidance. And there are certain circumstances where partnerships were soliciting investors and essentially offering investors the right to purchase charitable contribution deductions through these easements. And so what Secure 2.0 does is says you're not allowed to claim a charitable contribution if the value of the deduction is 2.5 exceeds 2.5 times the sum of the basis. So essentially, if the amount you've invested, if the deduction allowed is greater than 2.5 times what you've invested in the partnership, you would be disallowed this deduction. And that sort of finishes the walkthrough of the bill. And I'm happy to talk about this in more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an exciting bill. I consider it a page turner. On the issue in the summary here of distribution for 529 plans to Roths, 529s are supposed to be used for college tuition. Is this if the kids are graduated, they still have some in a 529 and they want to do something with it? Or?
Mr. Williams?
Chair Davids, or Chair Norris and Representative Davids, I think that's probably what was intended with this. So it doesn't specify that you have to sort of be done with college, but it allows you to take this distribution, if it's paid directly, into a Roth. And the tax treatment of 529 plans is pretty similar to how Roth IRAs are treated. And so I think that's sort of the intent.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. On that point, too, so what, these were federal things, right, in this here that just passed?
Mr. Williams?
Secure.
Chair Norris and Representative Anderson, yes, so this passed in the Consolidated Appropriations Act, so that was signed into law federally on December 27th of last year, and so we're sort of adopting these for state purposes. And there's quite a few other changes in the federal law that just don't affect state liability sort of directly. There's a few that actually resulted in forecast adjustments based on expected changes in taxpayer behavior, and I believe Ms. Templin could talk about that, but essentially this is just adopting these federal provisions for state purposes.
Thank you.
And members, just so you know, we do have a testifier, but before we do that, I'm going to go to Representative Davids.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, to Mr. Williams. We're talking about required minimum distributions being moved from 70.5 to now they're 72. They're going to 73 this year, and then they go to 75. What portion of the bill, so I can look at this a little bit, is addressed in?
Mr. Williams?
Chair Norris and Representative Davids. So it's not directly addressed in the bill text. That would be a change that was made in the federal law. And I don't think – so the required minimum distributions, essentially individuals take those, and then they're just included in taxable income because they're distributions from a retirement account. So there's no state action needed to adopt that change. And Ms. Templin, you may be able to discuss if there is a forecast adjustment on that piece.
Thank you.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, yes, I do have a list of forecast adjustments from the Department of Revenue and the provision for removing the required minimum distribution, I believe, is on the list. And if it is, I will provide that estimate to you. Thank you.
Representative Robbins, I've got you on the list. Would you be okay if we went to the agency first? Perfect. So let's go to Ms. Joanna Bears from the Department of Revenue. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Bears. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanna Bears, and I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Minnesota law relies on federal definition of income in the calculation of state tax, including exclusions, deductions, and other adjustments. When federal legislation is enacted that impacts the definition of income for Minnesota, a legislature must act to update the general conformity date. The general federal update makes it clear for taxpayers which set of tax rules apply for calculating income on a state return. Without a federal update, Minnesota tax law continues to operate under provisions in effect at the time of the last update. This complicates the tax filing process for Minnesota taxpayers who must make adjustments to the state income to account for the changes which Minnesota did not conform to. As you all know, the last general update Minnesota had was December 15th, 2022, when the conformity bill in January was enacted. At that time, we did not have sufficient information to provide a recommendation on the SECURE Act because it had recently been enacted on December 29th, 2022. So we just want to express our appreciation to the committee and the author for looking into federal conformity and taking further action on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bears. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Gomez, for bringing this bill. So I did want to ask Ms. Templin to kind of go through the changes from federal law that impacted the forecast. And if not, you know, if you could send us whatever you have written. And then secondly, I wanted to ask, is the intent that we comply with this for the tax year that taxpayers are already in the filing for? Or will this be retroactive? How is it going to land?
I'll maybe go to Mr. Williams first.
Chair Norris and Representative Robbins, on the effective date issue, these are all effective sort of retroactively at the same time the provisions were effective for federal purposes. So because it was enacted in 2022 at the end of the year, I think most of this stuff is going to affect tax year 2023 and later. There may be a couple provisions that would require amended returns, but my sense is that it's mostly perspective.
And then did you want me to go to Ms. Templin first on the fiscal impact? Or, yep, Representative Robinson.
Thank you. So just to be clear, if we – is this going to go to the general register or be part of our omnibus? Like, do we need to get this going faster, or are we good if it waits till the end of session?
Chair Gomez, do you want to field that one?
Yeah, thank you. I think our intent is to lay this over for inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, so there will be more opportunity for, like, you know, the information that you need from Ms. Templin and further conversation. Thank you.
And then Ms. Templin, there was a question about the fiscal impact of the bill. Any other questions or comments from members? All right. Seeing none, Chair Gomez renews her. Oh, I guess actually, Chair, do you have any final comments? Okay. All right. With that, Chair Gomez renews her motion that House File 2581 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. House File 2581 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
All right, next up we have House File 1419 from Representative Howard. Representative Howard is going to move that House File 1419 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And there is an A2 amendment. Representative Howard, did you want to move your amendment?
Yes, Chair Gomez.
Excellent. So the amendment has been moved. Do you want to talk about it, or should we just kind of talk about the bill after it's amended?
Up to you, Chair. I could briefly describe it.
Sure. Go ahead.
The A2 increases the floor of the aid that we're providing to counties, in particular at the benefit of greater Minnesota counties. It also expands the usage of the funds to get at the workforce housing issue in greater Minnesota.
Excellent. So Representative Howard has moved the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Amendment prevails, and the bill is in the form the author would like. Please tell us about your bill, Representative Howard.
Chair Gomez, members of the committee, Minnesota communities all across the state are facing unique housing challenges that threaten the economic strength of families and the economic future of their community and our state. Communities are trying hard to meet their community needs, but face immense pressures on their local budgets and their tax base to finance the kinds of housing development that is so critically needed. Over the past few years, I spent a lot of time talking to leaders all across the state about housing, and three things have become crystal clear to me. One is that every community all across Minnesota is facing a housing crisis and significant housing challenges, whether we're talking about urban, suburban, greater Minnesota regional centers, or rural counties. They're all facing housing challenges that are worsening year after year. Number two, the challenges facing our communities are unique. They're unique in terms of whether we're talking about the workforce challenges in greater Minnesota, or a suburban community trying to solve a naturally occurring affordable housing crisis, or to build the deeply affordable housing that's so in need in the metro area. And three is that the leaders in these communities have such a strong grasp of what is needed to address those challenges. but so often they don't have the resources needed to create and build the kind of housing their community so desperately needs. And that's what this bill is born out of, those three realities. This bill would create a local housing aid to counties and cities, and this bill would fund that at the amount of $300 million annually, which would create an estimated 4,500 new homes across the state at this level of investment, generating new tax base for counties and cities, helping meet the local needs of communities, and starting to address the significant and pervasive supply-demand gap in affordable housing all across the state. The permitted uses of this local housing aid are intentionally broad so that communities can address their local needs. They're even broader with the amendment we just adopted, in particular, so that greater Minnesota communities can focus on workforce housing challenges. This bill provides formula-based housing aid based on a formula on how much of communities are cost burden, meaning folks are paying more than 30% of their income in housing. And in Minnesota, more than 500,000 Minnesotans are cost burden. It's an issue all across the state. We deliver this aid to counties and to cities with population over 10,000. And we also create a set-aside fund for smaller cities to access the resources as well. I wanted to mention specifically a word on the set-aside for smaller cities. This came up in housing. The question begged is, why not provide the local aid to the small cities? Why have the cities go through this grant process? And this came out of our conversations with the League of Minnesota Cities. For resources to be used for housing production, there is a bit of a threshold to be able to use those resources to, you know, complete a housing a deal per se. And so the virtue of giving a small city, for example, a few thousand dollars a year, is that going to reach a level of impact? Probably not. But creating this set-aside would allow cities, if they have a project every other year, for example, to compete and provide more impact to build a project that's needed in their communities. Members, we need to be thinking outside of the box and delivering new sources of revenues to address our housing crisis. If we don't, we will not meet this moment that we're in, and that's what this bill is meant to do, to tailor the resources to the local needs and create a solution that will help create sorely needed housing all across the state. I'll note that in your packets there is distribution runs based on the amendment we just adopted for counties and for cities, so folks can and take a look at what an investment at this level would mean for your counties and for your cities. And with that, I'd welcome testimony.
Thank you, Representative Howard. First up for testifying, I have Mary Thompson. Welcome to the committee. Please just say your name at the beginning of your testimony and go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Thompson. I'm the executive director of the Heartland Lakes Development Commission. We are the economic development entity for Hubbard County and the city of Park Rapids. I am here today to testify in support of House File 1419 because it will provide a tool that counties can use to respond to local housing priorities. It may be a bit odd that an economic development organization is appearing to support housing aid bill, but now more than ever, housing is an economic development issue. We have a large number of employees in our county with open positions. The number one reason given for positions not filling is the applicant is not able to find suitable housing. This is having a direct impact on the ability of our county to prosper and grow. It has resulted in my organization taking an active role in housing development. In today's environment, the cost to construct both rental and owner-occupied units far exceeds the affordability for our primary workforce, those earning between 60 and 80% AMI, and the reason private development does not occur in this market. Currently, there are very few options available to counties to address workforce housing. Those that are available are more difficult to implement in small rural areas. This bill will provide resources, flexibility, and reasonable income requirements for counties to be able to address their own housing priorities. To show the impact and potential uses for this funding, I provided a handout that contains three projects that we are currently working on in Hubbard County. The first is a multifamily project in the city of Park Rapids. Originally, we intended to use Minnesota Housing's workforce program, but due to timing, we are trying to make the project work using all local resources. In either case, there is a large commitment required to be able to keep the rents at a level affordable to our workforce. The resources provided through this bill could be used to fund the required match for Minnesota Housing or that little bit extra needed to move the project forward. The second project is the creation of a subdivision that will support owner-occupied affordable workforce housing. In this case, Heartland Lakes purchased the property and are working to identify a resource to fund the construction of the infrastructure and make building lots available to private contractors so they can create affordable housing for our workforce. The last project is the creation of a countywide owner-occupied rehabilitation program. We must maintain our existing housing stock because we can't build enough to support the need of housing. In Hubbard County, 29% of homeowners are cost burdened, which would indicate they don't have resources to make home improvements. There is a portion of these cost burdened households that have incomes that exceed the limits for existing programs for owner-occupied rehabilitation. Hubbard County is working to create a program with local funding to meet the needs of these households that are stuck in the middle. This funding could help us support this effort. In closing, I want to also applaud the inclusion of the provision to allow the funds to be transferred to a local housing trust fund. Housing development is complicated and takes time, and 3 years may not be enough, especially if there isn't local capacity already in place in the county. It also may be necessary to accumulate resources for multiple years to pull off a project. Partnering with a local housing trust fund with unused resources will provide counties the ability to take full advantage of this new tool. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Todd Peterson. Welcome to the committee. Please just introduce yourself at the beginning and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Todd Peterson, and I serve as the Community Development Coordinator for the City of Roseau. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on behalf of the City and the League of Minnesota Cities and provide you with the Greater Minnesota City perspective regarding city support for House File 1419 and as amended.
That about my land.
Like many areas across the state, the City of Roseau and the County of Roseau are focused on innovating at the local level and utilizing our limited resources to address our locally identified housing needs. The City of Roseau has undertaken successful local efforts to address housing needs across our housing spectrum, from establishing a locally funded down payment assistance program to constructing new rental and owner-occupied housing supported with both TIF, tax abatement, and partnerships with our school, our county, HRA, and local industry. The City has also invested its limited resources and taken a leadership role in doing the development of both publicly and privately owned housing. Our biggest need in our region, as is true with many greater Minnesota cities, is the construction of new workforce housing that is affordable to the median income worker in Roseau. However, it is almost impossible to attract development, given that housing units built in our region generally cost more to build than they appraise for when they're complete, thus requiring resources for gap financing and developer assistance to attract any development at all. While we continue to pull every lever we can to assist with construction, preservation, and rehabilitation of a diverse housing stock, cost burdens and the general lack of available workforce housing continues to be pervasive in our community as the demand for more housing options continues to outpace our efforts. Hindering local economic growth as businesses like Polaris Industries and Marvin cannot expand locally because they cannot recruit out of the area talent due to a lack of available housing stock. And this is consistent with other cities across our region. As mentioned before, we continue to partner with local and regional organizations to address these needs, but we can't do it alone. If we are to be successful in addressing our local and regional housing needs, we need a strong state-local partnership that supports innovation at the local level and provides flexible resources for cities to meet their unique housing needs and challenges. While we have been able to access resources through various Minnesota housing programs, there is an immense need for more flexible resources that can be tailored to individual city housing needs. The issues of rural communities are different than urban ones. Small communities have different challenges than larger ones, and the solutions can be very different because of those unique characteristics. One-size-fits-all programs cannot adequately address these unique local housing challenges effectively. For example, Roseau has a homeless population that looks very different than one you would find in Minneapolis. Most of Roseau's homeless are homeless because of a lack of, not because of a lack of income, because of a lack of housing availability due to a lack of any housing available due to the economics of constructing new housing. Addressing this issue is very different than what would be needed in Minneapolis. The $210 million flexible local affordable housing aid distributed by a cost burden formula as called for in House File 1419 is an important step in expanding the state-local partnership to address housing and is consistent with our priorities to support housing efforts across the spectrum. Encourage local innovation through additional state resources and allowing state funding to be tailored to community-specific needs. Requiring a set-aside for communities like Roseau that are under 10,000 in population, as well as language that requires county-city coordination, will allow this aid to be more impactful in all regions of the state and not just the populous cities and counties. The amendment adopted by this committee will also ensure that cities like Roseau could utilize this aid to address our critical workforce housing needs. Establishing this program will mean that Roseau and cities across the state can do more to attract new development, assist residents with down payment assistance, and help our developer community bend the cost curve to make new and existing housing options available to our residents and support our local employers in recruiting new talent to our communities. Thank you, Representative Howard, for bringing this important bill forward, and thank you, Chair Gomez, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much, Mr. Peterson, for your testimony, and thank you for making the trip down. And I will mention that we have Mayor and Tax Chair Member Emeritus Fabian with us today. We do appreciate you all coming down, and I know that I think serving on the committee with you, Mayor Fabian, has helped me just to understand what you talked about, which is that there is immense regional variation in what our local partners need in order to meet the housing needs of our communities. And so I just really appreciate the flexibility of this approach that Chair Howard's brought forward. So thank you so much for being here. We know it was a long drive. So third up, we have Representative Commissioner Lori Halverson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, and appreciate your time today. As you have heard, the theme is flexibility. My name is Lori Halverson. I am a Dakota County Commissioner, and I'm also a member of the Dakota County Community Development Authority Board. Dakota County is a member of the Association of Minnesota Counties, which represents all 87 counties in the state, and we are a member of the Minnesota Intercounty Association as well, and both of these organizations have offered letters of support in regards to this bill. I want to thank Representative Howard for your leadership on this particular issue. This bill provides vital gap funding for local governments that we can put to use in the most effective ways for our communities. You've already heard the way that various communities will be responding. And I think that our Dakota County story is another one of those where we have got opportunities to put funding like this to work immediately in our communities to meet needs. Dakota County is working to ensure a comprehensive continuum of housing supports, and House File 1419 will provide these resources for our county to respond quickly for additional infrastructure needs for both individual and family workforce housing. Because Dakota County CDA works with our cities to identify housing needs, determine site locations, we are ready to go with three new projects that we could put these dollars to work on immediately. One is an expansion of our gateway workforce housing in West St. Paul, and we hear very often from employers about the need to make sure that people who they're trying to hire can work in our communities and live in our communities. And that's an additional 54 units, and we're looking at about a cost of $12.5 million. We also will be investing in a new family workforce townhome development in Farmington, which is further south and more rural than West St. Paul, with an additional 40 units, and a senior housing development in Invergrove Heights. And one of the important things to note is that the diversity of our communities really are reflected in these housing choices that we are making. About two-thirds of our affordable family housing that is built is occupied by families of color, and half these residents in our family affordable housing are children. We also hear that seniors who raised their families and had their careers in Dakota County want to continue to live in Dakota County. And so making sure that these options available continues to be important. And I will say it's important to us, not just as a board, but it's important to the community of Dakota County. And one of the most striking outcomes of a recent community survey that we did, when we asked our community, what are the issues facing Dakota County? Affordable housing was at the top of the list. And so it is something that people are feeling throughout the county. And our ability to respond quickly and with measured and well-researched responses to community need is further enhanced by this bill from Representative Howard. So I can urge your support. Thank you, members. And I want to say hello to our former mayor of Egan, Representative Anderson.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Commissioner. Thanks for being with us today. So we're going to move to member discussion. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Howard, I get the idea. It sounds like we've got a lot of consensus around this. When we look at, LGA or county program aid or other assistance that the state gives to our local units of government, there was a lot of conversation praising you about flexibility, saying we're thankful that we have some flexibility within this program. And my question to you is, why do we have it flexible within the context that it's spent this way? If the county commissioner that just spoke or a former state rep, why not just add these dollars to that general formula for relief for these counties or cities to do the projects that they're looking to do? Why are we, prescribing what they spend it on? We all understand that there's a need out there. Why don't we just put these dollars in the bottom line so that these folks can make the ultimate decision themselves?
Representative Howard.
Chair Gomez, Representative Swedzinski. Good question. They are flexible, but we do think there is a public need that we need to address, which is our affordable housing crisis. I don't think, for example, we'd want to be providing state resources for communities to, build new golf courses, for example. I think there is a fair conversation about what are the needs facing our state and our communities. And this is geared specifically towards our affordable housing crisis all across the state. It is flexible within that bucket of housing to try to address those challenges. But given the moment we're in and everything I've heard from communities, local officials all across the state, a revenue source specifically targeted toward housing is important and warranted in my estimation.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think your example potentially is unfortunate. I mean, I personally don't believe that if we're adding dollars to funding sources of LGA or county program aid, that we have that local elected officials who are the ultimate decisors on where these dollars are going to be spent, whether it's tax relief or housing or whatnot, are not going to, build a golf course if the state of Minnesota doesn't tell them what to do. I think we need to understand that these folks do understand, if we've got members of the public who are represented by their local districts or city councils or county commissioners, that, we can simply say, we'll believe that if you believe that there's a housing crisis in your district, that you will put those dollars that you get from the state first. And if it's tax relief, I don't believe they would make the choice that they're going to build if they have a true housing, crisis that we're talking about, that we don't have to prescribe every single dollar that goes out there, that they will address it, not build a golf course over an apartment complex. I think I get the idea, but I think we need to allow some flexibility beyond within the confines of housing. And trust that some of these folks are going to make some good decisions. So,
thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really like this bill, Rep. Howard. I think this is addressing a really important need. I do have some more wonky questions for you. So the bill does a very good job of specifying in 1.13 about what city distribution factor is and then what a cost burden household is later on in subheading 3 there. But I'm curious, there's the term gross rent used there. What is that figure? Is that for Minnesota as a whole? Is that a local average? Where is that figure taken from?
Representative Howard.
Chair Gomez, Representative Smith, and I might ask nonpartisan if I get this wrong, but this refers to the individual and what for themselves, the gross rents representing their household income. So we're saying that folks, this represents folks who's paying more than 30% of their household income in rent. That's what that piece refers to.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Smith. Representative Howard's description is accurate. This comes from the census data from the American Community Survey, so it's a federal standard being used.
Representative Smith.
Yeah, just to follow, I'm curious, just to kind of get down in the weeds here. So that, that census survey, how are they able to know what that gross rent is? I mean, are they surveying landlords? I mean, I have a follow-up to this on how we distribute this data, but I'm curious, how is that gained? How do they know what people are paying in rent income?
Mr. Cope.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know. I need to get back to you.
I know Mr. Williams, our ACS guy, is back there. I don't know if you have thoughts or... he's shrugging
Mr.
your
Williams
shoulders.
Is always around.
We'll see. We're just going to put him on the mic and see what happens. Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez and Representative Smith. So the American Community Survey is the normal census, but it's a smaller subsample of the population. So they would go out and just ask individuals what their rent is, and then the individuals would report their rent.
Okay.
And if I can just add they sort of do this more intensive survey of this smaller group of people periodically over time, right? So they kind of track them and develop a sample that they believe reflects the demographics of the different census tracts. And
Chair Gomez, so it's a survey that's conducted annually. It's a sample of the population, so the decennial census is attempting to contact every individual household, whereas this is just a subsample, and, the Census Bureau does, demographic weighting to try to develop a representative sample that sort of represents the population. For sort of smaller geographic areas, you typically pool together multiple years because you might not have sampled or surveyed a large number of people in a small geographic area, so the Census Bureau produces 3-year, 5-year, and 1-year estimates, depending on how many years you need to pool together. So you use a less recent number that contains multiple pooled years of surveys to sort of get a number that's a more accurate estimate for a smaller geography.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Yeah, thank you. That was very helpful. I guess my curiosity, and we should probably talk offline about this, but my concern with that is always, for particular my city, I'm going to be very selfish here in Rochester, Minnesota. Generally, we show high levels of affluence in these sort of things without taking into account a lot of our community that is suffering around this. Generally, I always want to check per capita, so I did a quick per capita calculation on the hypothetical city distributions here. Minneapolis is $21.02 per capita. Duluth is $20.06 per capita. St. Paul, $19.66. St. Cloud is $18, and Rochester gets $14.76. And I did the same thing with the counties. I don't want to go over those numbers specifically, but I would be concerned about that distribution. And we can talk offline about that.
So we have one more bill. I'm just looking at the clock. Sounds like there's a need for a little bit more conversation about the distribution, but Representative Howard?
Chair Gomez, Representative Smith, happy to continue the conversation offline. In this bill, Rochester would get $1.8 million. And, trying to find that sweet spot of a formula You know, it's always an inexact science to try to meet resources with the need. Using that figure of cost burden to us and folks that have developed feels like one of our best ways to sort of get at it, but happy to have that conversation offline.
Thank you, Representative Howard. Representative Smith, you good? Representative Robbins, you're up. Hold on, Swodzinski, not so fast. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Howard. I would like to get in on the distribution conversation that you're going to have with Representative Smith. This is of great concern to me. So I represent a very more rural part of Hennepin County. And whether the money comes through the county or through cities, we usually get left out. So the cities of Corcoran, Loretto, Greenfield, Independence do not qualify generally in either bucket because the county tends not to send money our way. I've got lots of charts to show that. And then we, even though we're under the population size, we're a metro county. So I want to also be part of this conversation because my cities always seem to be not part of any distribution, and they certainly have great housing needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Howard?
Chair Gomez, briefly I'll say happy to have a conversation because I'm sure there are housing challenges that are unique. We do have language that cities should be coordinating with counties, and ideally, how this would function is those cities would be eligible for sort of that RFP, that set-aside pot of resources to potentially, you know, access for a grant, you know, even a larger factor than if they were to receive a sort of population-based estimate. That's how it's structured, but would be happy to chat more offline.
Representative Swodzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to, you know, from an ownership perspective, does a county or city, will they ultimately own these projects?
Representative Howard.
Chair Gomez, it's flexible, so it's silent on that. We heard from our folks from Roseau. They've actually got in the development game and own some housing by virtue of not being able to find the right path forward. I think often you'll see this pot used for, you know, to fill a gap to make sure that a project will work either. And so it could be owned by a nonprofit entity or a for-profit entity.
Representative Swodzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so do those properties, whether they're owned by a nonprofit as an apartment, as an income-producing thing, or the city, do they pay local property taxes or statewide property taxes?
Representative Howard.
Chair Gomez, they sure do. And that's one of the benefits of a package like this, to try to create more housing that would generate more property tax base for cities and counties and communities across the state.
Representative Swodzinski.
So the city, if the city owns the project, they pay city property taxes?
Representative Howard. I see our city manager from Roseau's nodding his head in the affirmative, so okay. Maybe we can take that as a yes. Representative Swodzinski.
Madam Chair, why would they do that?
Why would they pay property tax? Why would a city pay property taxes to themselves? I mean, they're charging rent for the. We'll get Mr. Swanson up here so I can not try to reason through this. How about
we're making our nonpartisan the whole team?
I know.
Earn their keep.
We're tag teaming today. All right, Representative Swanson.
Madam,
Mr. Swanson, you know what's going on. It's a demotion.
Madam Chair and Representative Swodzinski. So generally speaking, if the property that's owned by a local unit of government would be exempt from property taxes, if that local unit of government, say, rented out the space or provided the space to be operated by a for-profit entity, or even in some cases a nonprofit entity, then that property could be subject to property taxes.
Representative Swodzinski? Great, thank you. So we're getting tight on time. I would ask we have a couple more members, but if we could just keep it brief. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Representative Howard, for bringing this forward. I like the thought of braiding city and county money together. I like the district. I missed a lot of the conversation, but I think the distribution model, looking at my own cities and knowing their needs, I think the number of people should really be looking at is the percent of the number of cost burden versus the population, and that gives you a true percentage, closer percentage to the need that's out there. And when I look at Hopkins, we have 65% rental, 40% BIPOC, and we're our lower income city in the West Metro. And we get about 18% of our, we get money on 18% of our folks are cost burden per population. And then St. Louis Park is around 12. And for me, that data kind of tracks with what I'm seeing in the market. And what we're really trying to do here, what I think you're really trying to do here with this money, is to provide those holes that we're seeing in the affordable housing development market when they go out to try to make those dollars meet up, and to fit that, you know, this is a good way for the state, through our cities and counties who know their areas better, to fill those gaps to get that housing built. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson is going to...
Thank you. Yep, yeah. I'll be very quick. Great. I won't even comment now. I just want to thank Commissioner Halverson. Where is she?
I think she took off. Did Is she back?
Okay.
Yeah, I saw her.
Things about her from my long former colleagues. So
that's great.
She's doing a great job. Thanks.
All right, thank you. So with that, Representative Howard, do you have any closing comments?
Chair Gomez, members of the committee, I can take a hint. Thank you very much for the robust discussion. I also specifically want to thank my testifiers, especially those that drove hours and hours to get here, and their work to inform this bill. And so thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, Representative Howard is going to renew his motion that House File 1419, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, and it is laid over. Next on the agenda, we have House File 2558 from Representative Norris. We dealt with Social Security, we dealt with housing, we dealt with federal conformity, and now we're going to deal with the White Claw tax. Representative Kosnick, this one is for you. So Vice Chair Norris is going to, that was a deep cut from like the first or second day of tax committee for those who are, paying attention. Rep Norris is going to move that House File 2558 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Welcome to your committee. I see you have props.
I did. It's not weed, Chair Gomez.
Oh, good. So no 5 pounds of weed under the table. No, he's no. Oh, yeah. We'll crack those open and then pass them around. You each get one swig.
I brought little Dixie cups for everybody. All right. Thank you, Chair Gomez and members. As Chair Gomez alluded to, back in the early days of session when we were doing the overview, you may remember that we were looking at the excise tax on alcohol, and there's kind of three main categories: beer, wine, and distilled spirits. And somebody brought up the question of how do we tax things like White Claw and other ready-to-drink cocktails? And sure enough, a bill came to me to address the situation. And, basically what we've got is a situation where the tax treatment of these is very different based on how the alcohol in the beverage is produced. So here you've got a malt beverage, and White Claw is actually a malt beverage as well. So White Claw would actually be taxed like beer, which is also a malt beverage, at 15 cents per gallon. Then you've got one like this, which is actually a wine or fermented, and that the tax treatment varies a little bit depending on whether it's under or above 14% ABV. If it's under 14% like this one is, this one's at 9% ABV, it's taxed at 30 cents a gallon. It jumps up to 95 cents a gallon if it's kind of your standard wine that's between 14 and 21% alcohol. But then you've got this one. This is a real rum cocktail. And because this the alcohol in this is distilled, it is taxed at the same rate as distilled spirits, which is $5.03 a gallon. So another way to, even though these are all, roughly the same amount of alcohol, same volume in here, they're taxed very differently. And you've got a handout in your packet that shows it a different way. This shows a couple of different types of alcoholic beverages. You've got a light beer at 4.2% alcohol by volume. It's taxed at about 1.4 cents per ounce. Same with a malt sugar seltzer like a White Claw, 1.4 cents. An IPA, that's a little bit, it's got a little bit more alcohol in it, 9% ABV, but that still is 1.4 cents. But then you get to a low spirit, ready to drink cocktail. Again, because it's a distilled spirit under the law, it jumps to 47.1 cents for the tax per ounce. So what this bill does is it basically tries to make sure that our taxes are on par with beverages of similar alcohol by volume. And so it would take a beverage like this with distilled spirits, if it's a ready-to-drink cocktail, under 14% alcohol by volume, and tax it at the same rate as wine in that 14 to 21% range, so 95 cents. So we'd be dropping it down from $5.03 per gallon to 95 cents per gallon. So that's kind of a high-level overview, Chair Gomez, and I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Excellent. We have a couple testifiers on the list. Joel Carlson. I think Representative Norris, when I joined the legislature, I was told never carry a bill about animals or a bill about booze, and I didn't pass that message on to you, but thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thanks for the advice right now.
A little late in the game, but.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Joel Carlson, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Wine and Spirit Wholesalers Association, and we appreciate you starting the conversation about tax parity with these products. And what we have learned, you didn't have this conversation in 2018 or 2019, or really until after the pandemic wore out, because the demand for these products, as people are healthy, they want low alcohol or no alcohol content, it is a rising share of the market because that's what people want. And so the suppliers that we represent have asked us to help them bring some tax parity to this marketplace. And, you know, this isn't about, it is really limited to that. I described it to somebody on the committee. You pour in the alcohol into your gin and tonic, and that alcohol is taxed at the excise rate level. And then you pour in the tonic, but you don't pay that full tax on that tonic. And that's exactly what we have going on here. We're just asking to be taxed at a more reasonable rate on the alcohol that's actually in the drink. It really isn't a comparison. It is in part a comparison between beer and wine, and I appreciate that. I mean, I've read the letters, and I appreciate they like to maintain market competitiveness by having a higher tax on their other products. But that's really not what we're trying to get you to think about. We want you to think about the fairness and the equity of this issue for similar-based products. And craft brewers in Minnesota, they got the best deal. They don't pay any excise tax until 25,000 barrels. And I appreciate that they maybe don't like this bill because of the differential that they enjoy right now, but that doesn't mean that it promotes fairness. And that's what we're asking you to consider. So, Madam Chair, with that, we're happy to answer questions about the bill. I think about 25 states have done this. Some states have not. They've considered it and not lowered the tax, at least not yet. But it is a trend that's growing across the country as the products become more popular, and we appreciate your consideration. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Carlson. Up next, to talk about these health beverages, Robert Galligan. That's what he called them, health beverage, healthy beverage, healthier beverage. I don't know. Health shake, I don't know. Nutritional beverages. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with
that. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. On that note, my name is Bob Galligan. I'm the Director of Government and Industry Relations for the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild. We are here today to show our opposition to House File 2558. For nearly a century, beer and spirits has been treated as different products, and it is our belief that the tax structure should continue to reflect that. Beer is much more expensive and labor-intensive to produce, ship, transport, and serve. The craft brewers of Minnesota take great pride in both the quality and the number of jobs that we provide. A shift in the taxes that are already in place could shift the landscape by which breweries are operating and thereby employing. Whereas a batch of beer takes an experienced brewer, sometimes multiple, given the size of a brewer, a knowledgeable cellar person, a competent packaging lead, and numerous people to serve and sell that beer, all in a tap room that the local community is familiar with and has chosen to support with their presence and dollars, a low alcohol volume prepackaged beverage requires the existence of a spirit already distilled, mixed with an additive, packaged, and sent out the door. Many of the day-to-day operations for the producers of these beverages are already performed by machines of steel as opposed to the hands of Minnesotans. Also troublesome is the financial impact to the state. According to an alcohol tax report done by Maryland's Alcohol and Tobacco Commission, two of the three states to enact similar tax changes in the last year have fiscal data showing a significant loss in tax revenue. The Liquor Control Commission in Michigan concluded that with all other variables being equal, the state lost $2.6 million it would have otherwise received in year one of lowering its taxes on similar beverages. In Nebraska, the state missed out on $1.8 million it would have otherwise received in just 18 months. Yet there has been no increase in the sales of these products to offset that lost revenue, nor a decrease in the cost of these products. In fact, these low alcohol volume prepackaged beverages costs went up at a rate higher than annual inflation. It is our hope that in the interests of the state's economy, but also more importantly its citizens, that this committee will join us in opposing House File 2558. Thank you for your time and your consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Galligan. So we're going to move to member discussion. Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a wondering, what is the what's the average demographic who consumes White Claws?
I think Representative Davids has an answer to that.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but this one, I don't drink, so I can't really tell you. So I'm that adverse to paying taxes.
I don't believe there's a White Claw-related question on the American Community Survey, so I'm going to leave Mr. Williams out of this. I saw Mr. Carlson come up, though. Did you have anything to contribute, please?
Mr. Chairman, or excuse me, Madam Chairman and Representative, I will get you some information offline. There's been a lot of consumer studies about who the demographics are, what they drink, why they drink it, and I'll get that to you offline.
Well, I assume this was a setup for a joke, though, Representative Swidzinski. Do you have any follow-up? Not to put you on the spot. All right, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm actually kind of surprised that we're even hearing this bill today, but you're the chair. That's fine. If you remember, was it last year we had the Chair Stevenson manifesto of a five-year rule moratorium, also known as detente, and here a major change in the, and you were absolutely right. I chaired the Commerce Committee for 6 years, and peace in the valley, except on these issues. This is, I am really surprised to see it's here because we need to have some balance. This is a major change, and I understand, and I said it when it happened, that one legislature cannot bind a future legislature. I get that. But I think in the spirit of what Chair Stevenson was trying to do, that we might just want to walk away from this one.
Thank you. Representative Mr. Carlson, did you?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Davids, I'll put you down as undecided. we absolutely and fully participated in the omnibus liquor bill of 2022. This is a tax issue. We're not changing the three-tier system in any way. This is not a commerce issue. It didn't get referred to commerce. This is just a straight tax issue of how do you tax these similar products. Another way that you can do it is just charge us tax on the alcohol that goes in the product. Just we only pay the excise tax on the actual alcohol. And if you want to look at it that way, we're happy to address that as well.
Thank you. Representative Koznick?
I'll pass.
Okay. Representative Joy.
Madam Chair, I do have to jump in on this one a little bit. Some questions he just said over there is, you know, we look at these taxes and where we're going to target and who we're going to target. You know, I'm in the tobacco industry. I sell tobacco, and, you know, tobacco get taxed more than vape. I mean, when we stop the discussions, when do we keep the discussions? I think it's something we got to look at, but I think there's maybe other options we can look at because we can pick out what we should tax and how it should be taxed. And like I say, nicotine comes from many different forms, and how do we tax that to the thing we do, tobacco or what? So I think this is definitely up for a good discussion and long discussion.
All right, thank you. Any further member discussion? I'm not seeing any. Representative Norris, did you have any closing comments for us?
Yeah, Thanks, Chair Gomez. And I'll just say, you know, I do think this is the start of a conversation. It's a hearing on the issue. It was one that, you know, came up during our overview, and now we're kind of bringing some additional facts to the situation, and we're going to lay the bill over and happy to continue the conversation with any of the stakeholders.
Thank you so much. And with that, Representative Norris renews his motion that House File 2558 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, and it is laid over. I believe it's a miracle that we finished pretty much on time. Thank you so much, everybody, for just letting us get through our agenda quickly. Just about this week, we are not going to use our tax time tomorrow because we got through the snacks. Should we all just come here to get snacks? That was why we had a special.
It was a party.
It was just a TBD. Meeting of the snack caucus will happen. So because there are some bills that we need to hear that are being referred from other committees, unfortunately, and I'm so sorry about this, but I'm going to have us all come back on Friday. I will bring snacks on Friday for sure. Okay. And so we're going to meet on Thursday. We're going to meet on Friday. And then, things are a little bit flexible, so we'll just be in communication about schedule in the next couple of weeks. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I won't be in taxes on Friday. I'll be in Texas, where we're having a tribute to my late sister by her employer. So we're going to head down to Austin.
That's Texas. Wonderful. Okay. Well, we're going to celebrate in your absence with some treats. And
you some, Madam Chair?
Yes, absolutely. And we wish you safe travels. Thank you. Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will there be remote options for Friday?
I don't think so, because this is our hearing room and we can't meet remotely. But the schedule is tight. I can certainly we will inquire if the room over in the Capitol happens to be open during our time, because, yeah, I know this is hard for those of y'all who live far away. So thanks for the question. Yeah, so we'll be back in touch about that. And with that, we are adjourned.